Extra time.
He shoots, and it's a goal!
Hello guys and welcome back to the Extra Time podcast. Today we are joined by the one and only Ted Knutson, the godfather of XG. I've christened you. Anyway.
I don't believe that's true. The godfather of XG might have been Charles Reap in 1997, which was a very long time ago.
Okay, so you got his own Wikipedia page?
I'm sure that he does,
I think
actually.
He does, yeah.
If not, then please just tweet Ted for, you know, direct information on him. I'm joined by Patrick Van Straaten. This is our first Extra Time Meets, where we sit down and we actually divulge, you know, on someone's career, on someone's, I suppose, interests in this space, you know. Bit of a Venn diagram here in that we steal a lot of what you do. anyway, so we have the Messi project as our title. I mean, it's not often we get to talk about, like, you know, Lionel Messi.
Yeah, he doesn't get much press, does he?
such a rarity. Actually, we don't cover him an awful lot on the podcast because there is very rarely a fresh angle to take, but you've kind of taken all angles and that has provided, you know, said freshness. So can you elaborate a little bit on what you've been doing at Stats Bomb with this kind of Messi in his career and all this data? So much data.
So Stats Bomb is a data company that changed a little over a year ago. And we started releasing some pieces of data to the public, soccer data, football data. I changed whoever I'm talking to. I was in the U.S. recently. Sorry about that. So football data can be hard to come by. So starting to work with it is challenging. So last year we released the Men's World Cup. This year released the Women's World Cup kind of every day, new games. And we were trying to think of like a broader men's release to potentially do. And basically we talked it over, couldn't figure out something we like until someone said, well, we could do like, you know, a deep historic one. And we did the 1999 treble. A few games out of that from Manchester United. That was James, one of my own podcast partners' perspectives. And I was like, you know, that sounds really cool. And then we're like, well, we could do like a couple seasons of Ronaldo and Messi or something like that. And I was like, we could just do all of Messi. And then it got really quiet. Like, that sounds good.
So why not all of Ronaldo? Just want to quickly interject there.
It could happen someday. We kind of wanted to wait until, you know, being sure he was not in jail when we released the information. So
I mean, that sounds extremely sensible.
Well, also, if you're going to pick a player, like Messi seems like the way to go.
I have a lean personally that he is possibly a better player than Ronaldo. Those of you listening to this podcast may have a different opinion. That's perfectly acceptable, but you're wrong.
Well, yeah. I just wanted that to segue into statistically. Messi's better. And then just end the conversation there before we move on. Yeah. There we go. Bang. So I don't need to ask any Ronaldo versus Messi questions. Pat, are you doing some reading today in The Sun, weren't you? On Stats Bomb's articles?
I thought you meant not in the newspaper, The Sun, like sitting in The Sun.
And you just lost all of Liverpool there. Yeah.
Enjoying the heat wave and enjoying some of Ted's articles. What questions sort of sprang out at first reading?
Well, to be honest, like I was just... It's kind of interesting to talk about Messi overall, I think, because like Messi seems to me like whenever you have conversations about Messi, you stop having conversations about football in some ways and start having conversations about like the limit of human ability, I always think.
Yeah.
To me, that question of Messi versus Ronaldo seems to have disappeared a little bit over the last couple of years. It only comes up every now and then from kind of disgruntled Ronaldo fans. And it just seems like the overwhelming sense I get from what I've seen is just like the completeness of Messi is just absolutely unrivaled, it seems.
But that's the thing that's in your head right now. Mm. And one of the cool parts about this data is that you get to piece him back together. He doesn't start out, his origin story is 91 minutes in 2004, 2005, right? Yeah. He doesn't start out as this fully fledged superhuman, which is what he is now. And part of the fun of this project has been dipping back into those early years from Frank Rijkaard, in an era when no one had any data. So like even the old data companies didn't really have the public data on this. The XY data we think doesn't even exist in like 05, 06. It didn't start with Opta until I think the 06, 07 season.
So when you say XY data, what is that? Just in layman's terms.
Sure. So, like, you know, we've got historic goals data. In some cases, we have historic assist data. But the location of every single event on the pitch didn't happen in his first two seasons. And so going back and going through a lot of pain to get a hold of this video and then having our collectors collect very fuzzy old school video, man, it's miserable. Like trying to trying to figure out who the players are, it can be quite challenging in those early days. But anyway, we get a chance to sort of really get a glimpse and rebuild the story of Lionel Messi, where everyone looks at the story of him as being like sort of born into this amazing Pep player. But he didn't even sort of become the false nine, I think, until at least full time until like 10, 11.
And so
like this is, you know, five seasons before that, we've got that information where he's playing constantly. And it's been really fun and kind of like enlightening in some sense.
I mean, if anything, it does make you appreciate, and I say this, you know, a little bit startled, appreciate his genius even more because of, instead of just kind of hyperbole, you know, exploring the numbers, interrogating the numbers, just reveals these little idiosyncratic things, doesn't it? One thing that I read specifically was when he went to the false nine, his sort of pass map and his average positioning was much deeper. He added 10, 20 passes on to the year before whilst still taking more shots.
Yeah.
And I was just like, how does that happen?
Yeah. And so when he starts in his early career, he's just a wide player on the right side. So he's inverted. He's almost exclusively left-footed. And that was kind of a thing that we've been surprised by recently because, you know, he obviously can. He has two great feet. And you see him warming up and you see him like do amazing things with his right foot. But in game situations, he's just very rarely passing and using his right. But so he starts out quite wide right. He's mostly a ball mover. He is immediately the world's best dribbler, which was also quite a surprise. And when we say this, you know, it sounds like, oh yeah, whatever, hyperbole. But like we're looking at a guy, say last year Adama Traore was completing something like 5.2 dribbles per 90 in the Premier League. So like, you know, a lot of substitute appearances, Adama is not Lionel Messi, but he dribbles pretty well. And there are a few others sort of in and around that space, like Sofiane Boufal, etc.
Yeah.
Messi's dribbling 7.5 to like 8 times a game at age, you know, 19, 20, 21 in one of by far the best leagues in the world. And he's doing this like right from the start, out wide. He's also creating for his teammates and he's scoring some goals. But those early years are still, you know, he didn't become this amazing phenomenon until Pep starts with him. And then he gets more central and the shot locations become better. And unbelievably, you have better shot locations, you have higher XG per shot, you score more goals. And he just kept improving on that and improving on that and improving on that. And, you know, at some point in the Pep era, he scores 50, right? And that's nuts. Just like a season
where
number.
A season where they won no major trophy, as I recall. They didn't win the league or the Champions League that year.
Real Madrid had their most amazing season that year as well and pipped them like a point or something like that. Those two teams were unreal. A bit like the Premier League this past season, I guess.
I mean, one of the biggest what the fuck moments I had reading your first, in the second article, in fact, you've released 2 of 4 at the moment, right?
Right. James York has been doing the write-ups, and then we've also released that to media partners kind of around the world. So you've seen it in Dutch or Arabic or Spanish or whatever.
So when we refer to this Messi project, I've predominantly been reading the articles that you've released on the Stats Bomb website, but you've also made the data available to, you know, amateur statisticians who can sort of do what they wish with it, I guess, bastardize it, you know, in any sense they deem fit. But yeah, one of the biggest WTF moments I had was, Messi completing 18 dribbles against Recreativo. And I think later topping that with 22 in a game.
22 in a game. In a game they didn't win.
Yeah, and didn't they end up drawing? An own goal and a set piece goal.
Yeah.
How do you beat 22? Well, not men.
A lot of luck.
There's the same guys, like a couple of guys who are victims of it 6 times a piece, right? It's just, so did you have any other moments that, could you maybe give us a bit of an inkling of what's to come? Is there any other bigger WTF moments than that, you know, from like an individual 90-minute basis?
Well, so right now, the first two releases were those first 4 seasons when he was still basically a teenager into the end of the Rijkaard era. And then the next 4 years are the Pep era. And the Pep era is when he becomes the most amazing player in the world, and not just from a goal scoring perspective, but he sets up his teammates. And then this next area is basically Messi independencia. So like Pep's gone, Messi kind of, you know, has, I wouldn't say control, but you know, he's now beyond that, and he's not sort of locked into the Pep system. I don't want to spoil anything, but like, we know that these seasons are amazing. They're just like incredible, and they don't stop. They just keep happening again and again and again. So like, this is Messi's prime. And even now, he's still doing amazing things, but we're seeing it change too. So like in the early era, you know, Messi's kind of involved in something like 20 to 40% of Barcelona's scoring moves. So, or moves that even generate a shot.
Sure.
And then like, as the Pep era goes on, it's 60, and then it's 70, and then it's 80. And like the tiki-taka style where, you know, Messi, they use Messi to pull guys out of position, and can they distort the defense so they can then get balls in behind. All of the through balls, like so many through balls, Henri on through, you know, I mean, Neymar in this coming era, like, is at the tail end of it. And there's a spot where Cesc shows up, and Cesc is just creating the, you know, Neymar and Messi are there, and they're just like unbelievably fast. And some teams will push up high to try and give them less space. And Cesc's just like, well, sure, I've been doing that pass all of my life. So I'll just put that on a plate for you, and you can score all of these throw balls. It's incredible. Yeah, and it's fun to do, because the guest stars in these periods are spectacular too. So we get a glimpse at Ronaldinho. We get young Iniesta. We get in his prime Xavi, and how he changes. I guess the other stonking thing, like the thing that's like really mind blowing, is like, this is the Messi project. But there's a point where Xavi, if you look at the way that our like the radars, you guys have probably seen the radars there. The outside of a ring for deep progressions, which is putting the ball basically into the final third via carrying it or passing it or dribbling it or whatever, it's 11.5. There's a point where Xavi has a season where it's 23 times that he's just like creating a ball in the final third for his teammates. Like, that's unbelievable. Like, no one does this.
And his defense is as well. Like, that was the thing that I was kind of stunned by looking at it. Because obviously, like, you guys, to me, it was the first time I saw possession adjusted statistics. And that was when you really saw defensive numbers pop for people playing for, you know, like, you saw them defensive Busquets, numbers,
for
pop
example.
Up.
Well,
someone like Thiago as well, you know, like, comes off well when you obviously you possession adjust their defensive numbers. But it's like 5-6 defensive actions that you're getting out of Xavi at this point, which is like not the player you think of him as these days. You see him pinging passes.
But he's got the ball at his feet 80% of the time. Yeah. So, it, you know, it only takes like a couple of tackles a game in order to be like, oh, wow, he's actually doing a decent amount of work for when the opponent has the ball.
And the same for Dani Alves. Like, Dani Alves to me was like, was actually the thing that had stood out to me here. Like, because somebody put up on Twitter using the data that they said that it looked like pretty much the only player who had consistently above a 60% tackle success rate against Messi over the 4 years between, what is it, 2004, 2008, is Dani Alves. And then they buy him in 2008, and he immediately is the best fullback in the world, maybe? Yeah. Like,
he was
like,
probably the best fullback before then, like, quietly. And he didn't have the teammates. Although those Sevilla teams were pretty good.
Yeah.
But then he becomes also, like, the best creator for Messi. Mm. So he's not only shutting everything down, he's recycling it back to Messi. And there was a quote from him last week in the news that was talking about, he's like super smart about football in ways that like Xavi sometimes is frustrating and says bad things. Alves just like gives you insight. So Alves is talking about Leo, and he's like, we had to keep Messi involved and pass it to him like every couple of minutes. Otherwise, you know, it kind of turns off, and you never want Messi to turn off. So like, you know, you just got to make sure that he gets the ball at his feet on a regular basis. Pep's like, sometimes, you know, I don't want to pass it to him wide because like, that's not the space that we necessarily want to occupy. And Alves is like, look, I just need to keep him active. You know, like, we need to keep him engaged in what's going on here.
Oh, this is like when you shake your mouse so that your laptop doesn't like go to sleep. Like, you just got to keep Messi like...
Yeah, it's nice to hear the more human side, you know, from someone who's just playing next to a deity. So you said you enjoyed kind of exploring the supporting cast as much as Messi. And I mean, there's some really fun parts in the article. Obviously, the Alves Messi dynamic being pretty prominent, I think, in the second article. Is there any players that made him I mean, I kind of know the answers to some of these questions, that made him noticeably better? Or did the absence of certain players make him noticeably better? Was there any surprises in that regard?
I don't think that we've tucked into it that much because it's so many seasons worth of information, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, I've been following Barcelona, but I wouldn't call myself like, you know, an avid fan. And I think that one of the cool parts about this is we're going to end up with basically between 12 and 15 years this summer, and then we may do like additional spaces behind it. So like it might be at the next international break, we'll release the next three seasons or something like that. But there's so much in it to tuck into, whether it's him or like people performing in the Clásico or whatever. I mean, obviously Alves is huge.
There's an interesting part about David Villa, and then his kind of seasons ended prematurely by injury.
Pedro as well.
Yeah, Pedro.
So the game really changes when he gets central. Mm. And then Villa and Pedro come along, and that also opens up kind of more lanes and more interactions with the two amazing central midfielders, Xavi and Iniesta, right? Iniesta kind of floats from wide to central to wide to central. He does everything, and he does everything nearly perfectly. He's almost like a Bergkampian character where like he just has this whole bag of skills and how do you best apply them? So like when Messi comes central and then Iniesta and Xavi are also central, Villa and Pedro are wide, like that's kind of the full active, you know, Death Star Pep system at the time. And so like that's been really fun to look at. I think that, you know, the Neymar era is going to get a little bit of scrutiny, especially with all of the rumors from the summer as well. And that's coming up. But like,
well, that's kind of what I wanted to build to, and maybe somewhat unfairly. Like I wanted to say, you know, what is the optimum front three, you know, from across his career? Is it as clean cut as, because a lot of people would say MSN, wouldn't they, instinctively? But Pedro and Villa, maybe pretty there hard to top most, in that period.
But that feels like you might argue there's maybe the most talent in MSN purely because the age Henry was by the time he went there. But it's Henry is unreal, like when he's there, like as a goal scoring forward at what, 29, 30? Like he's
30 to 31, I think, was those years before he goes to New York to play half the time for lots of money.
And where he was still unbelievable just as a pure creator.
It was almost as if his legs like didn't want to make the rest of the runs, so he just started pulling all the strings for everybody else.
Yeah.
I mean, that Henry early season was really strong. He's on the far side, so he doesn't interact as much with Messi. Messi hasn't moved central at that point so much. And I think, you know, when we look at the Neymar period, like when Messi goes out with like a hamstring injury for a chunk of a season, and he's very rarely been injured in the latter part of his career, like Neymar turns into Messi. And it's the only time outside of Kylian Mbappe this past year, and maybe Arjen Robben when he played in his prime previously, that we've seen that type of production in a top league. I wouldn't say that Neymar has continued on with that. Mbappe has kind of like accelerated literally and figuratively past him. But you know, it's pretty unusual. And it gives you an idea of like the amount of talent that Neymar has when he decided that he wanted to apply it.
When you say hitting that level, what does that kind of mean? What are the baselines that to you kind of like mean that you've pinged kind of Messi territory?
Yeah, you're kind of looking at like 1.1, 1.2 total expected goals and expected assists a game, which then gets you into the space that you're creating, say like, you know, 30 goals plus 10 assists or something, which is, I mean, it sounds like, oh yeah, whatever.
Numbers we've come to take for granted, yeah.
It's the kind of thing that if you did it once, that would be like enough to give you a reputation as one of the best in the world for 20 years. Like Suarez did it in that Premier League season.
That 13-14 season with Suarez and Sergio Aguero, where they were both out of this world good.
Yeah.
And it was one of the best Premier League seasons that we've seen. Yeah.
Enough for Mo Salah now to be worth 200 million when Messi was pretty much doing it in like his, well, the same age, and then he did it, you know, from there on in.
Well, and doing it by while being, you know, one of the most important passers on his side. Yeah.
I think that's another thing that we haven't tucked into because we haven't got the full set of data quite done and produced yet. But I'm reasonably certain that Messi is the best passer given the traffic that he passes through that we've ever seen. Like
you've touched upon it with the pass maps, haven't you? Like I was quite surprised the length extended as he came more central, and I guess that's by virtue of dropping off, but always out to that far left hand side. So does that kind of tap into how important his relationship with Jordi Alba is, just because he's always looking to pass into that space?
It certainly does. And also he's using the fact that he has gravity. So like we use this as a concept where he just attracts all of the defensive attention. And as that defensive attention sort of comes toward him central, that means that those are the open spaces that are then able to be exploited. Mm. The other thing that you find, is, and this is sort of pretty widely reported off of a Sloan paper from Javi Fernandez, who actually is a data scientist at Barcelona, is, you know, Messi's walking gravity is exceptional. And there was a Clásico where, like, you know, he won the Clásico despite, you know, walking the most of anybody on the pitch. So they're using the physical data to, like, you know, potentially want to flog him, but he's Messi, so he can't. But what you find is that they use tracking data and some pretty cool models to then suggest that by standing still, Messi creates more space for his teammates than anybody else on the pitch. And that's just because you have to pay all of the attention to him, and so that frees up his teammates to go into space.
That's crazy, isn't it?
Well, we noticed that, like, a couple of years ago, we went to the match where Barca beat Man City 4-0 at the Camp Nou, and Messi was on our side for the first half and walked pretty much the entire time. And then occasionally it's just like a kind of electric current goes through him, and he has that, like, perfect danger sense of, like, when to start running.
It's just as well he was still as well, because we were quite drunk while we were watching.
But also we were just grabbing each other the whole way through. Like, it was one of those things where you felt, like, kind of woozy, because we were like, we're actually seeing the greatest player of all time score a hat trick. Like I still can't quite believe that we saw that. You know, like, that's a thing I'll always have as a football fan.
But he does that a lot, you know.
That's true, actually. Now I think about it, it's not that special. Whereas I saw Jovinho score once, which is actually more like seeing a comet. Mm. Like,
but him inflicting that on Pep Guardiola was pretty special.
Yeah. I mean, that was also the game, though, where Claudio Bravo, like, came and tried to catch it outside the area. So there were extenuating circumstances.
I used to describe Jovinho as having, like, all the talent in the world until he got inside the penalty box. And then there was an electric charge on his testicles that then went off. As soon as he crosses that threshold, Arsenal fans can definitely relate back to that.
That would explain why he managed to score in that game, because I think it was from just outside the area.
There you go.
So, like, it didn't quite kick in. I don't know. It's weird how Messi... The thing that is kind of an interesting thing about Messi, because I found, looking at this data, that it feels like it's confirming stuff that you feel you know anecdotally to be true. Like, there's a guy called Lucas Tank who wrote a bit for Spiel Verlagerung, and he used to put together these kind of teams of the decade going back every 5 years, all the way back to the 60s. And he also did a team of all time, and it had Busquets, Xavi, and Messi in it, which I think is, you know, pretty fair in
pretty
all
punchy.
Regards. When he talks about Messi, it's interesting because, like, his kind of, like, poetic way of writing about Messi, I think, really maps on quite well to the data. Like, so he talks about Messi as Maradona schooled in La Masia, you know, where he has, like, all the talent of, you know, the Argentinian kind of teenager, plus that extra level of, like, the what you think of as, like, the Dutch Spanish kind of school of rationality. And he talks about how Messi, he says, when Messi doesn't do something genius, he does something right. Like, he never hurts his side. And that's where you see the difference to me between him and, you know, maybe a Ronaldo, and certainly someone like a Ronaldinho, who has that brilliance, but maybe isn't quite as consistent or doesn't quite... Sometimes they want to do the fun thing. And Messi just always wants to do the minimum amount of work it will require to help his team score. It just so happens that sometimes the simplest thing to help his team score is to beat 9 guys, take it around the keeper, tap it in. Like, he just looks at it that way. It's fascinating... watching, and I saw that in his, you see that in his shot map, right, under Pep Guardiola.
He's an executioner. When he gets close, like, the ball goes in, and I won't say that the game is done, but especially in those Pep years, it usually was, because it didn't take more than one goal in order to finish it off.
Yeah.
And he is, you know, there's the expected goals thing. Are you overperforming your expected goals? We know there are a couple of things that help you overperform expected goals. Hitting the ball really hard is useful because the keeper has less reaction time, and Messi does that. And then hitting the ball exactly in the corner is really useful because the keeper has less reaction time and they can't reach it. And then the last thing is the thing that I always have had such frustration when betting against Lionel Messi is his lift is so short. So his back lift is so short. He gets the ball out from underneath his feet so quickly that he creates unexpected shots sometimes. You're like, look, how did that ball come out of those people? And in a normal set of players that were then closing down that player, it would get blocked. But because Messi is just able to get the ball out so quickly, and it doesn't even have to be that fast, but it's then on target, he creates additional goals. And when he gets basically inside of the 12, it seems that he scores at just an insane rate compared to almost everybody else in the world.
Yeah, yeah. A hat-trick towards the end of the season against Sevilla, and I think all three goals were pretty much like that. Like zero backlift, absolutely. Defenders just left, right, and centre, and he's just found a way through. I think it might have been your part, or one of your articles on StatsBomb, where I could, the excitement was almost, you know, tangible as I read the words when you were sort of discussing the shot, Matt, that Pato alluded to. So they were all from the very sort of centre, weren't they? Apart from the free kicks, and they almost formed the perfect arc around his shots that were very much focused around the centre. So take us through, I guess, the process, the evolution of him, you know, shooting or becoming a more well-rounded striker from that right-hand side, you know, to the centre. What were some of the things that Pep Guardiola insisted on, and what are some of the things that just came, you know, naturally to him?
So before this data, we didn't understand, like, Messi's early years. None of that was publicly available. I think, like, the Who Scored data that anybody looks at is, like, 09-10. So previous to that, we don't see that Messi's this wide player that kind of has normal shot locations. He's still a good finisher, but he's taking shots from, you know, quite wide that are, you know, often like a 3-6% shot. Not great shots. Then as he starts to just realize that you need to be between the sticks, someone has presumably coached him this, and then he gets put in as sort of the false nine position where he's constantly in those positions. We suddenly see that, like, all of his shots are basically between the sticks and then inside the box. And the only ones that are really outside of the box are ones where the keeper is totally out of position, which we have that in our data now, or just free kicks. And it's also cool to see that he wasn't the free kick taker that he is now. Back in the day, it was Ronaldinho's team back then, and he was really good.
You also say in the article with Dani Alves as well, and that's a really good indication of the journey he's been on, isn't it? Imagine being third choice behind Ronaldinho, who was an exceptional free kick taker, Dani Alves, and then Messi. Everyone just kind of perceives him to be this master free kick taker.
But even when
it wasn't the case,
even once he became first choice free kick taker, it's still been like remarkable the last few years how it's just kicked up and up and up.
He's
right?
getting better.
Yaya Touré style.
Barcelona are also sort of screening the goalkeeper better as well.
Okay.
So,
nice.
And the thing about Messi is that he's got every club in his bag, sort of like a golf analogy, right?
Sure.
He can hit it hard and flat and straight and put it in the corner. He can frisbee it and it looks like it's going on one side and it frisbees all the way back into the side netting on the other side.
Yeah.
He can chip it. He can do everything, and it shouldn't be possible to do it that well. And that also means that he gets to take more free kicks from angles that other players wouldn't, because not every player has that ability. Like, you think of Ronaldo. Ronaldo's kind of like, he's been doing the knuckleball, and maybe he's got a bit of a topspin. But Messi's got side spin, he's got topspin, he's got flat. Like, it's incredible. And sort of, it gives him more opportunities to score these goals from free kicks. And the last couple of years have just been bonkers.
Were you expecting the trajectory of his kind of data career to look the way it does? Because, you know, often in young players, right, dribble numbers pop and then shot numbers, right? And then you tend to see creativity maybe come later in and shot location sort of improve a little bit into the middle, right?
I think if you were looking at kind of a normal age curve, you would see the dribble numbers as we see, but they're just astounding.
Yeah.
And then you see the creative numbers, and then you probably wouldn't expect them to see like the goal scoring numbers come. Mm-hmm. And that was a little bit, I mean, you know what's coming. So it's not like
sure.
it's not like you don't know what the plot says. Like, the plot has been played out already. But given kind of traditional development, he spoofed it almost, and he became this amazing goal scorer in ways that almost no one is. He's you know, the 5'7" Kal-El.
Would he have done that even if Pep, you know, wasn't instilled as manager?
I would say probably not, especially if he had a worse head coach. You would not have seen that happen. And the same is true of Raheem Sterling. We see Raheem's shot locations change significantly over the last couple of years. And he turns from a good young player, a very good, potentially young player from wide, into a great goal scorer, a great creator, always getting on the end of the ball and always making that run for the extra pass. So like the extra pass is one that's like a through ball that gets you 1v1 with the keeper, right? Like, that's a great pass. But Pep's teams make that additional pass where you're 1v1 with the keeper and the scorer doesn't shoot then.
The tap-in's always on.
Yes. So you get a little square ball to the far post, someone's there, and the tap-in's on. And you can see in your head Neymar and Sterling scoring that goal so many times.
Nice. I've got one more question. Sorry, Pat. I mean, not in total. That'd be a very short podcast. But while we're on that sort of subject, so Pep Guardiola, peak manager. Who would you have liked to have seen play with Messi during his peak years who didn't, from a statistical point of view? Is there one other player that's just really excited you, not as you've done this, maybe, you know, in a different period, that you thought he would have been one of the, you know, a perfect partner, a perfect foil for Lionel Messi? I mean, they're not in question. Short supply, but
it is a really interesting question. But the thing is, the ones that I might choose, like being an Arsenal fan, actually went there, right?
So
he got to play with Henri toward the tail end of Henri's career. He got to play with Cesc, where they didn't really know what to do with him, and that was like one of my regrets. Like Fabregas actually decided to be very flexible with his career and try to adapt to what these other managers wanted, despite the fact that it was pretty clear that Arsene Wenger was getting the most out of him tactically in the role that he was in. But, you know, they kind of tried to plug him in as a false nine for a bit.
Yeah, I remember him getting minutes as a nine and having great scoring numbers
that
season.
Yeah, he had a good goal scoring record, didn't he?
Why are you... I think Xavi held on longer than they expected, right, in the center
also
of the park.
True, but like Fabregas wasn't Xavi, right? Fabregas was a fully dynamic, you know, 10 that scored goals. And that was what we saw in the Premier League. And they wanted him to kind of like sublimate into a Xavi. And that wasn't really kind of his best thing. He's more almost like a Kevin De Bruyne now, you know, like really great. Balls that
like a free eight almost, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, really, Aaron Ramsey, right? Like Aaron Ramsey's goal scoring, but with even more creativity and you know, a tough tackler as well in those younger years. But you also saw Yaya, and Yaya was great.
Yeah,
you get Jordi Alba, who's one of the best, you know, modern left backs. Maybe Marcelo. Maybe Marcelo would have been the one.
That'd
where
nice.
And
we're all smiling.
That would have been fun.
But he's got the best right back that I've ever seen in the modern age that plays with him as well.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that he had great goalkeepers, especially in the early years. Like Valdez was good, but not great, and more with his feet. But you know, you can't argue with the success that
they
had.
Are we thinking that of the attacks that an Edison might have sprung if Lionel Messi was hanging around in the last man? That would have been pretty tasty. Imagine the dribble numbers down that left-hand side.
But you also feel a little bit like if you pick a fantasy teammate for Messi, then you feel like you might somehow subtract from the... you kind of don't want to change anything about Messi's career.
Yeah.
No, like, would I love to
I'm
see
happy
him play
with
Ozil or Bergkamp?
So,
yeah. But also then I feel like maybe the time that Ozil and Bergkamp have the ball, I'm going to be annoyed that Messi doesn't have the ball.
Well, I think these later years, we're seeing him do too much ball movement, though.
Sure.
I think the build-up play for Barcelona has suffered a bit in recent years, partly just because of dependence on Messi moving it forward, or maybe like it's a tactical set of choices. But I think that having all of those weapons at Barcelona, who didn't recruit well for a while, in that sort of early and middle period, like helped out a lot. And it's something that we've seen that overall team struggle a bit, not necessarily in La Liga, but in other places. Now, Messi's still getting his points and his goals and his assists, but that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, they're at the top of the Champions League and have great talent around him. I think they've got some holes.
So now he's kind of turned into like that, like expansion insulation foam, you know, now where it's just like, okay, you've got some bits and you just shove him in and he like covers all the issues. But like, so obviously they've got Frenkie de Jong in, but if you were kind of thinking about how you get the best out of Messi over the, what we assume will be the twilight of his career, but who knows at this point, like, what would you be kind of looking to do? What part of his ability would you want to kind of focus on getting the best out of?
Well, I know that you're going to protect him defensively,
sure.
Right? He's not going to do the defensive work. He knows that he doesn't quite have the legs to do like the fully active pressing anymore. So you have to put him in a position where he doesn't have to do that. He can't be Roberto Firmino and Lionel Messi at the same time.
Yeah.
The midfield stuff, I think they're working on a bit. I think last year, the last 2 years, they've given up 3-goal leads in the Champions League in weird situations.
Yeah, that's like a Champions League thing now, apparently, having never been before.
But he was visibly messy post-Liverpool. Like, Rome felt like a one-off.
Yeah.
And then it happened again, and it looked like he was very close to just demanding Valverde get the sack or something along those lines. Like, I've never seen him
weird.
So visibly
they're a good team, right? Roma were not a great team when they went through. Liverpool obviously are a great team, but still to pip this other great team, it's like no lead is safe anymore in the Champions League, even if you're Barcelona. But obviously, I mean, I think that means that we've seen some elements of Busquets struggling a bit physically to do the things that he used to do so incredibly well. He's still a great player, but you might need to, you know, have more depth and be able to rest these guys a little more during the season too. And will Messi allow that? I don't know.
So just some questions on the current Barcelona setup. So one, what do you think about, you know, Valverde's kind of stewardship? And it's almost become, there's a strong correlation with people disliking Valverde and people disliking Rakitic too, right? And I always feel like Rakitic bears the brunt of a lot of disgruntled fans. So I feel like he's more unfairly treated than Valverde. Maybe it's warranted somewhat with Valverde because he's very conservative and his substitutes are very uninspiring sometimes. But from a numbers perspective, like, what do you make of kind of the current state of affairs, at least with maybe, you know, personnel more so than performance?
With De Jong coming in, I think it's actually fairly promising because Artur is also quite promising as well.
Yeah.
So it feels like that midfield is now solidified.
Yeah, you liked Artur, didn't you?
Yeah, he's really good. The wide positions, you know, do you have the foil for Messi on the left? I don't know. I like Rakitic a lot. I have for a long time. It feels like Barcelona never quite respect their very, very good players that they have. Luka Modric gets all the plaudits over on the other side. Rakitic does like similar things and wins more leagues, but he hasn't won Champions Leagues as much, I guess. I don't know what that deal is. Or maybe they just always wanted to be Xavi, which, you know, that he's done now. He's retired. I think from a center back perspective, Umtiti was amazing, but it looks like physically he might have some issues that sort of complicate him playing regularly. And that was, you know, a great signing that they made that hasn't panned out for injury reasons, which is something you almost can't even predict.
Did you sympathize with them when they had the kind of defensive dip at the start of this campaign?
Exactly. And Piqué's not young. So, you know, like, how's your defense going to, especially from center back, going to continue for the next 3-4 Messi years? And then who's the partner up top, right? Because you need somebody who can run. He's got to replace some of Messi's running. He's also got to be able to run in behind. And you need somebody who can also like fit that system but score a bunch and create for his teammates. I think Suarez also looks like physically he's been a bit tired recently, we'll see how that works over the next coming years.
That's interesting. And Do you despair when Valverde lines up 4-4-2, or do you think it's just being pragmatic and it makes sense?
I don't even mind it that much. I think, you know, it's a little like PSG, where you're so good versus the rest of the league. In some ways, you're trying to make sure that you've got regular prep for the Champions League. So can we almost use the games as some prep for getting deeper against teams? Can we put ourselves in slightly challenging situations? It's weird to say that because, you know, Real Madrid are so far down that they just hadn't had any sort of competition for the league last year. That may start to change again in the coming years. I think Valverde's practicality works in a lot of ways because he works with Messi. You know, and if Messi's comfortable with a coach, that's fine. But maybe you need to push him into some level of discomfort or have the rest of the team, you know, be able to adapt in a way that you know, lets Messi do his thing while still being a little tactically better. I'm not sure. We'll find out more this season.
I'm getting some pro-Valverde sentiments. Do you sort of agree, Pato?
I don't want to be mean.
I mean, I get that. It's just with Valverde, it feels like...
it's just easier to hate him, right?
It's not even hating him. Like, he's obviously a perfectly competent coach. It's more that you just feel like, I don't know, it feels like you want to see Messi playing the best possible side. You want to see the best player ever playing the best possible side for the duration of his career. We've been unbelievably lucky that Messi has never had a long-term injury, like, throughout his career. Like, that's crazy when you look back at his
gift.
When you look back at his appearance numbers and you're like 36, 34, 35, 38, like in the league every season, like that's a real gift. But as a result, it kind of feels like I don't mind when Valverde like says, okay, we'll play Rakitic, you know, where we need to. We'll do what we need to with these guys, because I don't really care that much if someone like overcooks my hamburger. But like when they overcook my Chateaubriand, then I'm like pissed off. And that's kind of a little bit what it feels like with Messi. I'm just like, let him be the best player he could be. But to do that, maybe I just need Pep to be there.
Well, I would say that Barcelona do not play the same style that we see the very best teams play right now.
Yeah.
And part of that is because if he's not pressing, then you've got a hole in your press.
Sure.
So like there is an element of the late era Messi that is going to challenge you tactically that you're not able to overcome without like some very special players or without making him potentially a little uncomfortable and asking for a little more. Now, will late era Messi want to or be able to give that? Is he going to be like one of the NBA players that is like, look, I'm going to take a small veteran exemption and go play on the best team possible? Am I going to play, say, 25 games a year at my utmost and then be able to, you know, challenge for more Champions Leagues and more titles?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, that's a big question. And it's always like, these are superstars. Mm. He's been catered to forever because he should be, because he's amazing.
Yeah.
Mm. So I don't know.
I guess sometimes the issue was that he was rested and then he had to be brought on. I remember a game against Bilbao, I think maybe at the Nou Camp. He had to be brought on for the last half an hour because Barcelona was struggling. And then which defeated the object, which I suppose weakened Valverde's position in that, oh, you know, it's worth resting him. You know, we have bigger games coming up. And he was very, I mean, he still was very impactful when he came on.
Squad depth problem, though.
Yeah.
Like, they have, you know, Dembele needs to be healthy. Can he do the things
that... Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And
they don't trust Malcolm.
He's just... They haven't recruited great over the last couple of years. It needs to be better. It has been better this summer.
Yeah. You asked some good questions on recruitment, didn't you? Should we go for the transfer sort of mailbag?
Oh, yeah. We have some transfer mailbag stuff.
I don't even have my laptop in front of me.
Boy.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if some of these are answered with, no, I want to be paid for an answer to that question. but yeah, we've got some user-transmitted ones. What am I saying? User-submitted.
Yeah, that's the one. I quite like transmitted.
Came over the airwaves.
It says user. You've written user submitted here. It's like, is that what we're calling them now? Users. Like, they use us.
Okay. Sometimes it does feel like that.
Friends and fans. Yeah.
So now we're talking. So just a couple of transfers that are obviously rumoured at the moment. So obviously you're a Gooner. So I thought that we'd talk a little bit about Arsenal if we can, even though it's demoralising. So Hamill's actually a Celtic fan. So we thought we could maybe discuss Kieran Tierney a little bit.
So I was going to poke at him about Celtic. Have you seen the size of their wage bill?
Yes.
Why are they shit in Europe all the time?
I mean, I would love to give you a really well-rounded answer to that. I mean, in years gone by, Brendan Rodgers, as much as I enjoyed his brand of football, not conducive to progressing in the Champions League when you're facing, you know, superior talent.
Possibly. Also, didn't necessarily recruit superior talent. Often fought against it at Liverpool.
And, yeah.
Now he's fighting the good fight against it at Leicester, bringing in his guy.
We don't know this.
He's taken Lee Congerton.
I don't know. Like, as soon as I was like... Just don't mess with the way Leicester have been doing transfers.
Oh man, I was so excited about their transfers last year. I was like, ooh, this is a young team. They're going to grow together. They got a chance.
And now he's taking Lee Congerton to Leicester with him. So fantastic.
But he's probably getting pretty good advice. Let's put it that way.
Potentially. I mean, Neil Lennon was a lot more successful in the Champions League on a bit of a shoestring budget, and no one was being paid over 30 grand during that period.
Bolton were great too, and no one was being paid when he was there either. Wait, sorry. Anyway,
I mean, is he the right man for the job? That's not the question, guys. This is unfair. But let's go back to Kieran Tierney. One, do you think he's worth 25 mil? And two, would you be, well, I'm guessing you'd be happy to see anyone cross the threshold at Arsenal?
No.
But is he the right transfer?
That's such a non-Arsenal question thing to ask. Arsenal fan question thing to ask. Yeah. Like, you can't say, would this make you happy? Like, nothing makes you happy as an Arsenal fan. It can provide a sense of vague relief. Like, when we won the FA Cup against Hull, afterwards my then girlfriend said to me, like, are you happy? And I was like, no, not at all. I'm just glad that it's done.
But I think you guys, to an extent, revel in the despair.
No.
I think you love it.
I feel despair in the despair.
I think you love it.
When was the last time they won a league title?
2004.
Yeah, 15 years.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Hence Kieran Tierney, title-winning pedigree.
Spurs recently in the Champions League final.
Yeah.
You can understand the despair. Back to Kieran Tierney. Okay, so is he worth 25 million? Now, I do this professionally and have done this professionally since 2014, so I've got a different perspective on it, and I'm going to make Celtic fans angry, and for that, I'm sorry, but... Scottish Premier League football is bad. Mm. Okay? Like let's just be honest about that. Half of the league is League One quality, not League One. League One is good league. League One quality in England. So if half of your opponents are that quality and say half of them are sort of lower Premier League, maybe upper Championship, should you be paying 25 billion for a player that plays against them that has performed quite well? But has a lot of potential risk behind it because, you know, this is who he's playing against. I would say no. Now, are you looking at, say, I think the more correct price, at least, you know, from a, a professional perspective, is like 12 to 15 with maybe some add-ons or a sell-on fee. 25, I would have concerns. Like, why aren't you looking at other left backs? Like, at that range, right? Can you get somebody from any of the other big leagues that you have, you know, a fair amount of confidence as to how good the quality is? Now, I like him a lot. It's weird that Scotland's best players are both left backs. But
does it offset some of your worries that his numbers, he sustained those numbers in both the Champions League and the Europa League, and he's kind of Celtic's predominant creator in those competitions?
But you could also argue injury record, like in response to that, right?
Do you know who else we had a very strong argument about, at least from fans, about their Champions League performance?
Come on.
Senk Tosun.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that didn't work out either, did it?
Yeah, but, you know, Kieran Tierney wasn't 3 stone overweight when...
25 million, same price.
When he joined Sam Allardyce's revolution. yeah, I mean...
Wait, how overweight was Fat Sam?
I think, from a Celtic fan's perspective, and obviously you're being very...
That always precedes something incredibly rational.
You're being very prudent. But you're being very prudent there, yeah? Very fiscally responsible there. But there's the old argument, he's worth X amount to us, right? I think I would have taken, I mean, the deal totaling 25, yeah, okay, fine. Like 15 to 20 up front, great. You know, with some very realistic add-ons, I think that's a fair deal for all parties concerned. Do you now think that Arsenal are starting to border enter the territory where... they're going to annoy Celtic. Celtic won't sell Tierney, and you won't have a sort of better alternative.
It's quite low risk annoying Celtic, I think.
Why would
Celtic be annoyed? Like, Arsenal are offering like 25 currently, we assume, including add-ons, right? Like, that is a perfectly reasonable offer. Like, and you don't go in and offer Celtic don't sound annoyed. Lennon basically says we have a valuation. If it's not met, we don't sell.
Okay, so
that seems like a reasonable position.
So even add-ons aside, if a current deal, it's hard to kind of... It's hard to unpick that, right, without knowing what the add-ons are. But
or even
why
to
not
know
offer
what
just,
the offer is, yeah, right? Because like, there's lies everywhere.
Yeah. Sure. Why, at this point, so the window closed on the 8th, right? So two and a bit weeks. At this point, next week at the very least, as Arsenal fans, you're not just thinking, just pay the 25?
No, because Arsenal don't have that much budget. Like, you can't do that. That's what got them into the situation. Just pay the like 70 million for Aubameyang, which shouldn't have been 70 million because who are you bidding against? these deals, you've got to be sensible and you need to drive a correct bargain. And the teams that I've worked with do very well in the transfer market, but like you have to have the right framework behind it. Who exactly lost to, was it Welsh part timers in Europa League qualifying last week from Scotland? Was it...
I mean, Killy? I'm not kept up
was
on the early stages. Kilmarnock, yeah? Yeah, I think my Kilmarnock.
Welsh part-timers. Couldn't get past those guys in Europa League. So, again, I have some pretty strong feelings about the quality of Scottish football. It could be better.
Yeah, for sure.
25 million?
I mean, you won't catch me sort of taking it personally because I assure you, as someone who has to watch it, I can agree your sentiments. Although there is... a sense of like umbrage when you see, it's Andy Robertson went for what I think under 2 million from Dundee United when he was young player of the year to Hull, and then he sold on to Liverpool and now he's worth X amount. You know, Virgil van Dijk, I think there's a sense among Celtic fans that he was always going to become an elite centre half.
They weren't the finished product when they left.
No, but then you wouldn't say that he was worth, for example, Virgil van Dijk after 18 months at Southampton was worth five times more.
Probably three. Like, Liverpool ended up overpaying for various reasons, including an apology for unsettling him, right?
We also got 10% of that, I think. So.
Well, exactly, and that's fine. But if you're paying 25 million for a left back, like, you're paying for the finished product. Mm. Like, he needs to start right now, and he needs to be really good.
Mm. I think he would, and I think he could be a left back for the next 10 years.
I think that is possible, but I'm concerned about the probability that he might also not be, which that's it's all in the price.
Well, that's the difference in space, isn't it? Like, so for instance, like, you can say like, we were pretty certain Virgil van Dijk would be elite, but what does elite mean? Does it mean like top half of the Premier League quality? Does it mean Champions League quality? Or does it mean the best centre back in the world quality? Mm. Like, I think, I'm not sure many Celtic fans would have bet a lot of money on that, but they might well have bet on him being certainly good enough for a Champions League side.
Yeah, I'd
and the
say
same could be
elite
true of Tierney.
Champions League and the Premier League would probably put you in the top 10 for your position, maybe,
in Europe's top five.
Maybe. I followed Tierney for a good three seasons now, and I think he's quite exciting. I just, you know, if it were someone different, if it weren't Arsenal, then they might have the ability to just pay that, right? Like if it's United, you're exactly. whatever, 25. Like Arsenal are super constrained because of a lot of dumb moves over the last 3-4 years.
Yeah. Though it's quite heartening that they seem to have targeted younger players this summer for once, like having all the short-term moves having not worked out spectacularly. Like though then we always have to have at least one dumb move to even it out, and this summer it's Zaha, which actually, well, I don't know, the money is so insane, but you could argue it's less dumb than some others, maybe. Like I didn't like Leno at the time. He was actually pretty good last season. I didn't like Socrates at the time.
Well, the question about Leno wasn't ever his talent. It was like the lapses, right? Like they were just goals that were scored against him regularly in the Bundesliga that should not have been.
Yeah.
And I know personally his coaches that were there, they're like, you know, I have questions of him ever being top tier because of this type of stuff.
Wow.
And, you know, he performed quite well last year. One of the open questions is, you know, maybe a different goalkeeper coach helps, right?
Sure.
And that's like a huge...
Not traditionally a strength of Arsenal.
I was going to say, historically...
Well, exactly, right?
But the guy with one hip, wasn't he like our goalkeeper coach for a minute?
He had Fabianski and Szczesny conducting an interview in Polish, both dressed in awful attire. Just absolutely slagging Arsenal's goalkeeper.
But more importantly...
But that was before. So that was, you know, the last year of the Wenger era, I think, was at that point. Then it was a totally
Unai
new goalkeeper
overhaul.
Yeah, and quite positive things coming out of the staff from the new goalkeeper coach. I think he's actually done a couple of talks around the sort of nerd talk circuit. Pato, why aren't you there?
The nerd talk circuit. I'm not invited.
So you know what? I'm going to invite both of you to attend the Stats Bomb conference.
Excellent.
October 11th, Stamford Bridge. It's all nerds and
I almost stamped my feet then out of excitement.
I would love to. It's the only thing that will get me into Stamford Bridge.
So we've got like two different talks or sections going on. One of them is going to be more mainstream. So for you, Mr. Hamill, then maybe you'll be in that room mostly. And then there's like a research room that will be like featured researchers. So, you know, it looks like we're going to have someone from Barcelona there. Someone from Ajax talking about some really cool stuff. Let's see, who am I forgetting?
You've called it. I'll bring the celery.
Yeah, not only are you allowed to come, you're invited. I will offer you tickets.
Appreciate that.
Are we going to be on video?
We will bring chips and dip.
Is it going to be video or is it going to be like just a microphone? You'll be walking around sort of doing Vox Talk type stuff.
Yeah, pretty much. Just selfie sticks. that's our level of production value.
I want the montage of you guys walking really fast up to the stadium though. That's what I want.
We will always have one of those.
Excellent.
The camera on the ground. So should we do a couple more quick hits?
For sure.
We did about 10 minutes there on Scottish football.
Yes, you've football all fell numbers. Victim of my
so
agenda.
I've got one more Arsenal one, then we'll move on. Do you take Everton at 35 million, the player, not the club?
Okay.
I'd take the club. Zaha at 55 million. I'm being super generous there. Ismail Assar at 25 or Chukwueze at 30 mil?
Ooh, good question.
Not Zaha.
Yeah, agreed.
Everton, fairly large risk at that price.
Have you got any, before we move on to the other players, any insight on Everton? Because I'm a big fan of Tite, a big fan of Brazil's national setup. Like, he was good at the Copa, but what else is there about him?
Well, that's the question, right? And Brazilian players are often overpriced versus the market, right?
Sure.
They do produce the best talent. They also produce a lot of guys that probably shouldn't go for like 30 to 40 million that get sold for 30 to 40 million and then wash out for various ways and float around like the Spanish league for a while until eventually going back. Or like Leandro Damião, who's, you know, potentially sold 15 different times and never actually is good enough to go elsewhere. Chukwueze is pretty interesting. Look, I think the answer is I'm not sure about the exact prices because I'm not recruiting for Arsenal on those other three, but I'm certainly more interested in the other three than I am in Zaha.
Yeah, agreed.
Nice. Which one would you go for, Pato?
Of those four, to me, Everton's an unknown quantity.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have access to any data on him. Like, and also from what I can see, he looks like more of a shooter. He dribbles and shoots a lot.
It feels a little bit like Rikarlison. I don't know if that's a lazy,
23.
A lazy comparison.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Someone that's kind of started out wide and looks like they might have a future centrally as a striker.
So I think Rikarlison actually causes more problems by being in that that space between the fullback and the center back, because neither one of them get to handle him in the way that they want to.
He's
too strong for a fullback, and so I would probably leave him wide or put him as like a front two in maybe a 3-5-2, so that he can, like, he's just physically problematic for everybody.
Yeah, he was one of a very small number of players. This might have been Michael Kaler, it might have been you, said that there was a very small number of players in the Prem the season before last who were completing a couple of dribbles a game, getting a couple of shots a game, and winning a couple of aerial duels a game. And he and Lukaku, like those kind of guys who are just, yeah, physical mismatches for most people they come up against.
Yeah, and in the Premier League, everybody's pretty good physically. So if you're still a mismatch there, like, you're something special.
Yeah, definitely.
And he adjusted quickly. Like, I don't feel like when he first arrived, he was necessarily a physical specimen. Like, he had the stature that you can add muscle to that. But he did really quickly, but this which bodes well, doesn't
this
it?
This is the thing with him, though. Like, this is the thing with Everton, actually. Like at 35 mil, you just feel like there are these... If you want to get one of these young forwards, you can get somebody super young and take gambles. And that's what Arsenal should have been doing from the moment that StatsDNA came in. You know, like, they should have been... Because Wenger always said, well, we can't buy the finished article, it's too expensive.
But you can certainly buy guys that were probably the finished article.
Yeah.
And if you've got a 70% likelihood of him being, you know, a Champions League starter in 2 to 3 years, and you can do that deal, you know, almost every other year, if nothing else, on either side, that is the right way to run your company or your club or whatever. The difference now is that the transfer market is becoming a little more competitive.
Yeah.
But you still have to be really careful about these gambles. You know, 25 million is not an insignificant number for a team that is worried about revenue and is not going to get any money from their owner. Mm. You know, it's a bit like AC Milan, who are not the giants that they used to be, spending a whole bunch of money on Paqueta.
Yeah,
like, Paqueta might be good, but, you know, aren't there other ways that you could spend that?
Yeah.
Speaking of which, there's a transfer that I like. Do you guys know Diadi Samuseku at all?
No,
is he at Salzburg?
He was, yeah. And apparently, he's gone to Dortmund.
Okay.
Is it Dortmund?
I'm frustrated because
is he Malian?
I believe,
because they've got a real hotline to Mali, right?
Yeah,
like, they get all the best talent.
Yes, exactly, and pull out some great players. So I know he was looked at by a number of big clubs, and, you know, it was kind of the classic thing where, like, you know, there isn't great talent that comes through there, whether it's Salzburg or whatever. Like, Salzburg now are pretty clearly a talent pipeline, but I think the number that Dortmund paid is only 20 million, and that's euros. So you're looking at a starting defensive midfielder for a Champions League team and one of the good ones, and you got him for 20 million. So this is the difference in the stuff that we're talking about. And you could have bought him for the exact same price a year before and probably should have.
And you look at Watford as well. Like when I think about young forwards, I think about the fact that Watford last season had Dodi Lukebakio out on loan in the Bundesliga and then Cucho Hernandez out on loan in La Liga, and both looked like potentially outstanding young centre forwards. And Watford and Leicester can afford to make these moves. Like, it's strange that Arsenal haven't been making these gambles. But on the topic of Samuseku, like, what about Xaver Schlager, who's gone off to Wolfsburg, also out of the Austrian league, I think.
Yeah, right? would have bought him in a heartbeat. Like, went for 15 million, I think, to Wolfsburg, and, you know, looks like a sort of dynamic eight. It's the type of risk that you want your team to take, and probably should be taking, especially if you want to gradually get better. The thing about Arsenal, or even Man United to some extent, although United have so much money, like, the frustrating bit is they're just not making moves that get them better. And last year, Arsenal did a number of moves that seemed like they were trying to get back in the Champions League. I'm like, look, don't do a one-year punt to try and get in the Champions League. Rebuild to the point you're going to finish fifth or sixth anyway. So rebuild over, like, a two-year plan, which, you know, it is about what it takes, to then be regularly competing for, like, that 2-3-4 potentially an occasional first, maybe. Could we win a title some fucking day?
Well, this was the argument I felt for selling one of the forwards, like, this summer, that you're like, does the next great Arsenal side, and by the next great Arsenal side, I mean a side that is competing for a title, like, does the next great Arsenal side have either of these players in it?
Nope.
No, it doesn't. It's too far off.
It didn't have Alexis Sanchez in it either.
Yeah.
Didn't sell Aaron Ramsey. Didn't sell... can we move on?
I feel like... because obviously the people don't know at home where the proximity of where I'm sitting, but it's like a tennis match between two disgruntled Arsenal fans.
It's that's what it's all about. Like,
I'm just going
though, right?
From side to side to side.
There are so many Arsenal fans in the office, and when you don't want to talk about Arsenal, it's really demoralising.
Some other really interesting transfers. Well, I mean, more high profile than the ones you've just mentioned, I guess, coming out of Salzburg, in that, like, Hadara going to RB Leipzig, and De Boer. I wonder what. your thoughts were on De Boer going to Sevilla, because that felt like a relatively low fee. I think it was sort of early to mid 20s, right? And his goal scoring record was exceptional.
Sure, but he's not young.
Right? Yeah.
And he also is kind of powered by the engine behind them. Marco Rosa, I thought, actually.
A bit more of a system player.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's fine at finishing, and that's what they need, but he's not a dynamo. I wouldn't be nearly as excited about him as I was like about Ben Yedder when Ben Yedder was like a kid at Toulouse.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, watching and seeing what happens with Marco Rosa and Rene Maric at Gladbach this year will also be pretty exciting, and we'll see how well they do. But who was it? There was another Austrian manager that was at LASK that was it, did he go to Wolfsburg too? So anyway, Bundesliga should be a lot better this year, I think, is my final point on this. Yeah. And it'll be fun to watch in ways that it hasn't been recently.
And the whole Hummels thing, if we're talking Bundesliga, no. I mean, it looks...
We've had arguments about this. Yeah. I hate the Hummels thing.
It looks like
the
a worse...
So, it's so much money.
It looks like a worse deal. So I didn't mind it. And I thought they could have used a player like him at the tail end of last season when Akanji, Diallo and Zagadou, when they'll sort of be moved around, right? Although Diallo was very good at left back.
Diallo was amazing at left back. It's like two dribbles a game.
But now,
centre back.
Now Diallo has been moved on for €32 million.
Which, given they paid 28, like, that makes no sense to me at all.
But it makes the whole Hummels thing a little bit nonsensical.
So I think the Hummels thing was they were looking for more leaders and guys that understood the club, and it's almost like traditional football stuff that I try to avoid. But I understand a little bit of it, and he likes it, and. You know, Royce, they've also kept, and you know, Favre is a pretty specific manager, and so if he decided that was probably what they needed to get them over the hump, you know, maybe they looked at this last year and thought that was the right choice, and you have a leader there. But Hummels isn't the same player as he was 5 years ago, and to me, you know, there are some concerns that maybe he isn't good enough to lead them regularly. I don't know.
Has there been one transfer on the continent that you've hated this summer? Can you even say that as someone who tries to work with people in that field?
I think the most recent one was just signing Charlie Adam to like any deal, and Reading like picked him up, and he was so...
Charlie Adam to Reading was not expecting that. Brilliant.
Excruciatingly bad over the last 2 years. And Stoke fans were like so happy to see the back of him that it kind of really does tell you like how awful Charlie was for that period of time. I don't, you know, there's still some dumb transfers like happening out there. I think this actually is a good segue into some of the questions we got about like how much are teams using stats and data in their recruitment. I think England has gotten a lot smarter in the last 2 years. Mm. And I say this as someone who owns a data company now, but you know, watches the transfer market really closely, because you know, you can usually see the fingerprints of people that are using data, like Spurs right now. The rumors about Spurs and who they're targeting, very clear data signs. Almost exactly the same types of players that certainly fit the system in ways that it never looked like they were doing before. So you think that, you know, either they got lucky or they're getting good advice from somewhere. And we say good advice, I mean, advice that I would give is kind of that doesn't mean it's always right.
It's hard to work from the opposite assumption.
So how much until Lo Celso becomes not worth pursuing? Because obviously a lot of fees been banded around.
It's right at the edge. You know, you're looking at 60 to 65 is probably the outside that you want to pay. You know, Batiste, like I guess leveraged him for like what, 30 or 32, maybe even slightly less than that. So like they're just flipping for you know, 100% or possibly even 200% profit. And obviously a great choice. His data profile at PSG was lightning. And you're like, okay, this guy looks like everything that he was touted to be. But PSG and their sort of corner that they backed themselves into with FFP, you know, they made some deals that you might not do with like full amounts of freedom, I guess. So the question then becomes, you know, who is and is not? And I can't tell you that because that'll get me in trouble. But I think some of the obvious ones are still shocking because it costs them so little. Like the amount that it would cost a giant club to invest in data and smart people like Liverpool are doing, and like Liverpool are having great success at doing, is a tiny fraction of, you know, what they pay for agent fees for a year or any number of other things. And in fact, they could probably cut back on agent fees by having these people around.
Sure.
I can still say England has gotten a lot smarter. Other countries, like Italy and Spain, probably much less so. And partly because I guess a lot of the analytics research has been written in English. So it might not have gone, you know, directly to them and
proliferated as quick.
Yeah, disseminated in that way. Germany's kind of interesting in that, like, they do a lot of homegrown stuff with German, you know, companies. I think Frankfurt are pretty analytically smart and have done some great moves and also have good scouting.
So you back them to turn over that Seb Haller, Luka Jovic kind of
It's tough overhaul. To turn over two Champions League forwards. Mm. And
especially when everyone knows you've got that money now. You've got like 100 mil in your pocket.
Well, they had Jetro too, and Jetro was like a good pickup. Sure. Didn't use him for long throws as much as they should have, but Jetro Willems looked like the left back of the future for a while.
Yeah, yeah, at PSV.
Yeah, and you've got to, you know, sometimes you got to make sure that the mentality stays on target, but, you know, Jetro's another good one. So they, you know, there's a reason why they were there, and Adi Hütter is a guy that we interviewed way back at Midtjylland for the replacement role, and I thought he should have been signed because I think he's truly exceptional. So he's another one to watch. They didn't play his full style last year because they kind of burnt their smaller squad, didn't want to burn out the pressing stuff in the Europa League. So they didn't have enough depth to kind of go full speed ahead. But if you watch when he took over Young Boys, like, they were doing excruciating things as of the first game. And apparently some of the players threw up at the end of the match on the sideline of the pitch. Wow. But they won 4-2. So there you go.
That's fine then. Like, I mean, interesting, when you were talking about, like, kind of seeing the fingerprints of, like, data scientists, like, on transfers, like, it feels like that's kind of what's happened with, like, Joel Linton, like, going to Newcastle. Mm. Like, because, what, 12 goal involvements last season, but expected goals, it's more like 15, I think, something like that. And also his numbers, like, it's like 0.6 XG and XA per 90, isn't it? It's, like, filthy.
But how useful is it to have player recruitment that at that level and then not have coach recruitment that aligns with it?
Yeah, sure.
Like the whole Crystal Palace fiasco with
De Boer.
Yeah. Was it Frank?
Yes.
Yeah. Poor old Frank.
Though then, like, they massively underperformed in those first few games, right? And then suddenly got decent, like, and were pretty good for the rest of the season. And you're like, oh, well, shocker.
Yeah, but it was the reverse, wasn't it? As in the manager, they didn't back the manager. They didn't give him enough money.
In almost any way.
To buy that profile of player. Whereas Steve Bruce, if it was like, we can now spend £40 million on a player because Steve Bruce agreed to be paid £1 million for the year. and Sheffield Wednesday will probably get jack shit in return. The Joel Linton one is interesting. I also, so a player that underperformed expected goals, potentially, is Joaquim Correa at Lazio. And he's been touted for a big money move to Atletico Madrid. And I was wondering, one, have you got an opinion on him? And two, is there a player who you think is kind of chronically undervalued out there at the moment who we can have as a freebie? You know, I could slip you this 20 under the table, but...
Well, I'll just say that we're not doing a lot of recruitment in that space right now. So, like, you know, names that you would be excited by are not necessarily names that we've looked at. And it really does change. Like, you know, our data goes down to English League 2. And so sometimes we're advising clubs in League One and players that they can afford that no one will ever hear about for the most part, and, you know, perfectly sensible
Jordan
reasons.
Jordan Hugill. We all heard about him by accident.
Well, yeah, that was another clear one. We were like, why is that happening? Because he doesn't look like he's good enough for that club. Like Jonas Lossel was another one where you're like, he was rated as one of the two worst shot-stopping goalkeepers and was the first one to move this summer in the Premier League. And that one was just like odd. You don't know what happened. Maybe their goalkeeper coach like saw something that you didn't and felt that he could improve pretty quickly. Mm. And that's the other thing too. Like, you give advice and you sort of give, hey, we think that this is this guy's, you know, average the way that he'll work out, and this is his peak. Like, if we have a great you know, couple years with him, this is what he's going to look like. But if he washes out, what's the worst case scenario? Correa, there's a couple of Correas actually. He's not the one that he's not the one that Milan are rumored to like.
Yeah, that's Atletico. So.
Yeah,
I'd like to see him play more.
I like Angel, maybe not for the price rumored, and that's always the question. Like, I think a big one that I would ask you guys about is like, what do you do with Dybala? Like, assume that Juve have to sell somebody and they don't have a magic money tree in the back of their garden that someone has planted for them. Like, what do you do with Dybala and where do you put him that he can succeed?
I sell almost anyone to keep Dybala. Like, I think, like, to me, Dybala feels like the best. He feels like the best fit for the way that I assume Sarri wants to play based on what I know of Sarri. Like you had Insigne, then you had Hazard, and the guy who maps onto that best is Dybala. Like, and
I don't think he has the same dribbling ability, and particularly not from that left side.
No, but I could. But then I suppose if you do keep Cancelo and you can play him off the right and basically like flip your system, then you get some of that out of Cancelo. You know, the way they got it out of Goulam, like at Napoli, maybe.
Okay.
But then I want to play Bernardeschi. I want to play Dybala. I mean, I wouldn't have signed Ronaldo.
That ship sailed.
They've got so many old guys. Like, it's one of those things where, like, I love a load of their moves this summer. I didn't like Ramsey. I don't like him for that much money. Like, I don't. Kadir is still there, not doing much.
Oh, Kadir is not playing.
Matuidi, they want to get rid of. Chan isn't playing as much as I would like him to. Chan looks great. Bentancur looked like a great player who also isn't was playing as much as I like. Spent a load of money on the defense.
Bentancur, I would like pick up in a heartbeat at any top team. Like I think he's truly outstanding. Yeah. Another guy there is like in Italy that went to Inter. Like Lautaro went for I think $20 million or something like that.
Martinez.
Oh, and he looks amazing.
Yeah.
He looks like a superstar.
He was a guy that we looked at and was like, that is a fantastic deal. Like somebody found like a gem, polished it up, because he was basically over a 4-year period the number one guy that we had rated coming out of there. So and they got him for a reasonable cheap price.
He stepped in very ably when a whole Icardi situation. So came to the fore, didn't he? Yeah.
Another guy that's like totally burnt his bridges. No one wants him around. They can't sell him, they don't know what to do.
Well, that is exactly his. I felt his next evolution was Juventus, was to play for the best team in that league, which he was consistently brilliant in. But now we've arrived at the point where he's not worth the hassle. And for a player with that much ability, it takes a lot of baggage to burn those bridges. But it's happened.
You don't have Chelsea, basically. That's your problem.
Yeah, I mean,
Chelsea are always like your kind of like
failsafe for disgruntled players.
If you've been a shithead, then Chelsea will be a bigger shithead. Like you can offload something on them.
And I feel like
they'd have been Coutinho's landing spot, right? This summer,
least offensive option to sell to, right? Because they're not going to be. I don't think anyone sees them as like a. I don't want to upset a few Chelsea fans say this, like another historical elite team with Champions League pedigree. It's not like like Juventus selling to Man United or to Real Madrid or to Barca. I feel like a lot of clubs don't, especially Chelsea of late, I suppose, while Abramovich has been a little bit more indifferent, see them as kind of operating in the sphere or at the sharp end of the stick, let's say.
Are they just taking the ban?
It
looks like they are, right?
Yeah, I think it's done. I think their appeal got turned down, didn't it?
I don't think so. Or they might not have like even
filed.
Or
they just decided to like ride it this year.
Exactly. So like I was informed by some pretty in the know people that they definitely felt like they could get a stay on the ban. But it looks like they might just take it, which I think is a huge surprise. It would explain bringing in Lampard, the PR behind it.
Yeah, accepting this as a down period.
Yeah, and just really finding out what they have in the academy for the first time in their history.
Why not?
I think that's a fascinating move and not something that anybody I talked to 2, 3, 4 months ago would have said was likely to happen.
And does that... I mean... As an Arsenal fan, like, brilliant, because there's, it does seem like fourth spot is still up for grabs, or, is still sort of semi-realistic. But can you see any of that Chelsea talent? We've spoke about Tammy a lot. We spoke about Mason Mount a lot on our shows. Do you see any of them arriving in a meaningful sense? Do you think they're ready now to accumulate minutes, Premier League minutes?
Yeah, I thought Callum and Tammy were certainly ready to at least play like sort of the second role there. And Chelsea are quite old in those wide positions. So unfortunately, he got injured, or Hudson-Odoi got injured. I think that they've also got some decent depth. Like I think Christensen should be playing regularly. Sure. And I think that he's good. But
Conte was a huge fan of Christensen, wasn't he?
Yeah, Conte being a fan of somebody, it's got a shelf life.
Transient,
a bit like his own time at a particular club. I think that there is some real depth there, and some of the ones like we just haven't seen tested at this level. But Matt Miazga was a guy brought in from the US, and he's going to be at Reading again this year. So like you're still going to see a lot of loans go out. I
guess I'm asking if there's any cause for optimism amongst Chelsea fans.
You're going to get me in trouble if we start talking about Lampard stats. So I'm just going to pass on that one they weren't.
And the next stats bomb, like you said, conference, is at Stamford Bridge. You don't mean locked out of your own conference, do you? So fair play. We got any other kind of names on the end of that list? Because I know there was a...
Oh, just a couple more, maybe. Junior Firpo to Barcelona, potentially.
Rumoured that they bid for him this morning as well.
Oh, really?
Or at least for an advanced talk, or, you know, considering a bid.
Interesting.
I have no insight on that one. I apologise.
No worries.
I'm stupid.
No worries. And the other one was, I wanted to know if you agreed with me about Enoch Kwateng should have gone to a bigger club than Bordeaux.
Yes. The French... So this particular market this year has been really odd. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of good bargains that came out, and including Marcus Thuram, I thought.
It was 9 mil in the end or something.
Really quite cheap. But then also, like, it hasn't moved. Like, the market hasn't moved at all. And I talked to some people recently who basically felt that it was like Harry Maguire, like waiting on that and maybe, you know, possibly Neymar donking around or something like that to really kind of like get everything in motion.
Oh, okay.
So there are a couple of, you know, potentially quite large bids and deals that haven't happened. Another reason, and we've talked about it a little bit on our own podcast, is simply that teams are really trying to leverage the Premier League, because the Premier League cuts off their market at the point the season starts. The rest of Europe isn't doing that right now. Mm. And because of that, it means that the Premier League has to go first and they've got more pressure to move now. And so you're able to hold them hostage a little bit on prices. But if they decide not to let that happen, then they don't have to. Okay. I think the other thing that kind of comes into play a little bit here is just simply the domestic TV rights versus the rest of the world. The Premier League sees it as like, oh, okay, so the market for TV rights is slowing down considerably. And we want to start to be a little bit careful. And so we can't just allow the inflation that's happened in recent years. I don't know that that's, you know, 100% guiding, and the teams are their own entities. But it's certainly something that they're aware of and will have been briefed on from the top of the PL.
So you think hopefully we might see a bit more activity, or at least some interesting transfers, when the Premier League window shuts kind of on the 8th? Because then people are dealing, I guess, more on a level playing field, I want to say.
Yeah, I'm not even sure on that one. I think when we look at it, Liverpool and City are quite comfortable with what they've got. And
Pepe at Liverpool.
No.
Damn.
I don't think that's likely. I also think that Liverpool won't overpay for him because they know exactly what he's like. So they're not... They're looking at, okay, he's got 10 penalties. So, like, you know, he's like a 35 million pound striker or wide forward as opposed to, you know, a 60 million. And they're not going to get sort of tricked into paying that, is my guess anyway. So I think that those two teams, like, are very well aware. I think we're seeing Spurs, and Spurs are still, like, making a lot of moves or behind the scenes that may result in final signings there. Arsenal are a mess. United are a mess. Chelsea looks like they're taking the ban. And then Leicester are kind of adapting a little bit to Rodgers being there, you know, giving him support. You know, Wolves are doing a little bit. So basically, I think what we're seeing is there are a lot of teams that are kind of comfortable with where they're at. There are a couple of teams that are in crisis for various reasons. They haven't solved those crises. Like, Chelsea aren't going to be able to overcome their ban if they decide to take it. Maybe it's better to take it this year. So, yeah, what's the point in spunking a whole bunch of money unless you're really excited by somebody?
Yeah, okay. So I guess... I mean, after the first few weeks of the transfer market, it has been quite still since...
Except for Villa.
Quite ominous. Oh my God, yeah. I mean...
Loads of Villa fans really mad at me on Twitter.
Don't get me started.
They found a clip of us where I said Tyrone Mings was like maybe not worth 26 mil.
But yeah, Celtic, comparatively, Celtic well within the right to ask for 25 mil. Tyrone Mings is going for 28. And that brings us... You know, look at that. We've gone full circle. Very nice. Did you have any more transfers to ask out before I go to final questions?
I think I'm good. Though I will say that think that often, like, we talk about the transfer market as being quiet. And yeah, overall it has been quiet. But there are also moves that we just don't pay attention to. Like, Juve had, before they brought in De Ligt, like, Juve had already spent, you know, 30 mil on a defender from Genoa. They brought in Demiral as well for maybe high teens. Like, so there are moves like that that go on that we don't necessarily pay attention to.
It's true. Juve also seem to own, like, or be part owners still of half the young players in Italy, so it's useful.
I get very nostalgic when I think about you know, part ownerships. It reminds me of trying to sign Adriano from Parma, both Parma and someone else. I can't remember. I'm football manager,
exactly.
Yeah, I mean, this brings me to our fan questions in no way whatsoever, but, you know, what a smooth segue that was. So actually, a lot of fans, because we've really tried to put kind of statistical analysis at the heart of what we do as well. I mean, not to obviously the same degree, but to kind of back up opinion with facts, or at least as much facts as we can get hands on. The fans have really embraced this culture and they got really excited at you coming on. So we've got some fan questions here. First one comes from Mubarak, and he's asked, how does Spurs fare with Eriksen, Ali, Ndombele, Lo Celso and Winks in midfield? I guess he's asking, if they do sign Lo Celso, how close are they to competing for second?
Possibly pretty good. I mean, it depends on Kane, right? Like, that's a big wild card for them. And also it depends on replacing their two starting fullbacks, who are 28 years old. You know, I think they're probably capable. If I were a Spurs fan, I would be pretty excited by the moves and the rumors that you've been associated with. The issue that felt like Spurs had last year was, like, they just limped across the line. Like, no real depth, especially depth of talent. And so now, all of a sudden, you know, they will be more resilient with that midfield. Winks doesn't have to play a huge role unless they want him to. And that, I think, is actually pretty exciting. The big question is, I think the two moves that we kind of talked about, the transfer window that didn't happen, that were, like, very strongly rumored early on, were Eriksen and Pogba. And why aren't they moving? Is that going to happen? You know, Eriksen obviously wants a big final deal. He's ready for a payday. Real Madrid seem to be the most likely suitors. But if he can't get that, what happens? And maybe he stays at Spurs and signs a new deal and, you know, takes a moderate good payday as opposed to, like, a big one that you get at Real. That's a great midfield, though.
Yeah, who'd have thought, you know, given the sentiments they sort of came out with very early on in the transfer window, that they'd still be exactly where they are, with sort of with rumours kind of cooling off somewhat as well. You had an interesting point on Transfer Review about Sessegnon and your thoughts about his sort of Spurs recruiting him as a left back.
No, I like Sessegnon a lot. I like him as a signing. It just seems like a very odd move. It seems like a strange idea to get rid of Danny Rose and assume that Sessegnon's going to be a Premier League level fullback now. Like, what it suggests to me is that you expect to go into the season with Ben Davis as your primary left back.
But Pochettino is the fullback whisperer.
Sure.
But they just get better under him. Guys that shouldn't be that good.
Well, like, yeah, Ben Davis didn't look like much before he went there, did he?
Kieran Trippier didn't defend like he did under Pochettino. And so give him full credit for that. If you give him some pretty good raw talent that's close, you know, I think that he's possibly the most capable coach of coaching up those guys to an elite level.
Yeah.
So the Poch effect sort of offsets that.
Yeah, you look at it and
unreadiness.
Say, yeah, and also homegrown element too. So Sessegnon is English and almost certainly going to be a starter at the English left back during the course of his next contract.
He will be a left back, you think?
I think likely. Yes, I think that he didn't light enough things on fire to move him up, but maybe they look at it and say, you know, he's definitely a left back, and if things work out, we can move him forward because like our wide guys aren't that young right now either. So, you know, Spurs might need to bolster in that area of the next couple seasons.
Cool. Okay, so there you have it, Mubarak, maybe finishing second. I think with those additions, comfortably third, though. Liam 98 Wilson, how often do football clubs use this data to aid their transfer business? I think he was alluding, you know, to exactly what you do. And if they don't, when do you think they'll start? I mean, why don't we start at your, you know, stats bombs kind of beginnings, which, correct me if I'm wrong, is kind of, you know, Brentford territory, right?
Yeah, started with Brentford and Midtjylland, 2014, summer of. And was there at those clubs for a couple seasons, won a title with Midtjylland, and then, you know, Brentford finished in the playoffs the first year under Warbs, who's now at QPR, and then, you know, top 10 in the second year. We never quite got to the point that we wanted to in terms of, like, the style of play that we wanted. We weren't taking the long throws at Brentford like we were at Midtjylland, but, you know, it was still a really fun period to do it. And that, like, I came back out and I thought that the world would have changed, right? Like, we're having this success and people will see it and stats will be used a bunch. And it didn't happen. That was, like, a big surprise for me. So I was like, all right, so what next? And ended up founding StatsBomb as a company as opposed to just a blog. And that's, you know, the first year we did kind of business intelligence layer. We built, you know, we were using these tools and developing these ideas inside of the football clubs. And we're like, okay, I think that football is going to be ready to use these widespread in the coming years. And so we did that, and then we decided that we needed better data to be able to really kind of dig into players and tactics and stuff like that. So we made our own data. And I will tell you that, like, you know, 2016 versus now, quite a bit of change. We're seeing a lot more clubs excited about data use, willing to incorporate it, especially in recruitment. Recruitment, there's like not even an argument anymore across most of the clubs, at least at the Premier League. Championship is still adapting a little bit. League One, you know, probably less so. We work all around the world. We've got a club that is tearing up that we work with in the US that is amazing, doing a lot of things that we're really happy about. I think that still, though, there are plenty of holdouts. And part of it is just like, you know, football's different, right?
Is the resistance cultural? Mainly?
Like, yeah, when you think of who director of football or coaches are, like, they're mostly ex-players. Mm-hmm. And so they're not people that have analytics degrees, or, you know, even many of them don't have interest in statistics. But when you just tell them, hey, we're going to give you better information, and you put it in a visual way that makes it easier for them to understand, then they get on board. And I think that that's kind of the next phase of what's going on there. But I'm still personally surprised by some of the holdouts and teams that places that shouldn't be holding out, like, just have no real interest in doing this in a way that is going to make a difference for them. But Liverpool, on the other hand, have done an amazing job with a lot of very smart people and completely bought into this process, and it explains why they're so damn successful.
But it's weird that nobody seems to have that people don't seem to have quite grasped that. Like, it felt in a way like it needed a kind of case study, right? Like, it needed like this one team to kind of go and blow competition away, and then people would take notice. And yet that's happened, and a lot of people are still not really paying attention to it. And instead, it's kind of like,
Jurgen
Klopp, or these were signings that everyone would have made.
Sure, you know? Right, they were certainly not signings that everyone would
have made. Yeah, exactly. Everyone's just like, well, of course Mo Salah was going to be a winner. And I was like, well, I remember doing a show with Danny Mills where he felt very differently.
But. Yeah, exactly. And you look at like the Twitter replies when we were talking about it, and like, oh, washed out at Chelsea, did this, that. Roberto Firmino, I was like, man, I'm really excited by this Firmino signing, because he can do all sorts of things. He can play, like, we had him more as a 10 or sort of like an elite 8 that was super creator but can also score. And then he also had this really high level of defensive output, a bit like Alexis Sanchez back in the day. I mean, they were not signings that everyone would have made. That's like post-facto rationalizing. And that's one of the reasons why I've left my Twitter stuff up, is like, you know, we don't always get it right. I certainly don't always get it right. But I think that, you know, on the whole, when you look backwards, we get it right an awful lot of times versus the conventional wisdom, which is what you're fighting against. And Liverpool are doing things that, you know, are continuing to innovate, like, not least by hiring a long throw coach, which, once again, you see the dinosaurs saying, well, everyone knows how to throw the ball in. Like, what sort of Premier League coach can't teach players to throw the ball in? Pick up the ball, throw it to your teammate. Hold on to the ball. Like, well, that's not what happens. And in fact, you get the shit pressed out of you in the modern Premier League, and you actually need to be a little bit thoughtful about what's going on. Otherwise, you're going to lose the ball.
I mean, that's fascinating. So let's quickly deviate into something really boring. Brentford, not often I have a Brentford insider. Romain Sawyers?
Yeah.
Celtic have been linked with him.
Oh, Jesus.
Worth pursuing?
He's a lovely passer of the ball. I'm not sure that he's going to press much, if you guys still press, but I don't know if Lennon's tactical setup has that, like Rodgers did. Rodgers, you get pressed more. But like, he's really silky and in possession, a really exciting player.
We already have one of them, Tom Rogic. Someone that's really exciting in possession and does not a lot of physical activity in between. last question then from Patrick McElligott. How does someone get into your field of work?
So my pinned tweet on my Twitter account, which is Mixed Canuts, kind of explains a bit about this. The way that, you know, the learning journey is very much the same as when I got started. So you want to have some statistical background, but you don't necessarily need a degree. You need to prove that you know how to use stats, and like, you're not going to make dumb mistakes. And then like, knowing football is really useful as well, obviously. And you see lots of academic research that just doesn't understand the game. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, teams now especially are able to investigate that. They know the football side of it. So if you don't know football very well, if you make like bad assumptions, like, you won't be able to find a job there. I found that data visualization is hugely useful. And this package of sort of like analyst logic, a bit of coding, whether it's R or Python. And if you want any help with that, the Lionel Messi data project that we've done also has an R primer, both in English and Spanish, to help you get started in that. So like, we've kind of helped build the training wheels to be able to start this type of job. So the coding, the statistics, and then you start writing about it. The data visualization, I think, gets your work noticed better. And when teams bring somebody in. Like if you've got that skill set, like that's really exciting. But the bonus of all of this is building that skill set actually gives you a very valuable skill set for the business world as well. So you can make a ton of money working in the business world and, you know, maybe do some stuff on the sidelines, maybe you make your money at a really good job for like 5 years. And then they're like, oh, okay, well I've been building a blog that's been noticed and now I've got a chance to go work for a team. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty cool. So that's kind of how it works out for most people. I cannot say that I'm an expert though, because I've only actually been hired for one football job. All of my previous experience was in the gambling sector, professional gambler or helping run and rebuild Pinnacle Sports. And then now I run a company that works in and around football, but it's not really a football job because I hired myself.
Can I endorse you for gambling on LinkedIn? Is that on there?
It probably is.
So from, you know, as someone who uses stats as sort of glorified pub ammo, you know, I'm not always going mega deep, you know, enjoy it on occasions. What are some of the do's and don'ts of kind of using it at that level? So have you seen any kind of, you know, misuse of stats? Would you recommend, you know, cross-referencing, you know, two different metrics? Like, is there any little bit nuggets for our mixed canuts in there? You know, like mix and matching crosses with you know, dribbles completed.
Sample size.
Give me some easy formula, Ted.
All right. So, like, you want to be aware of sample size. Like, if a guy's performed well in five games, but like that's all that you got, like you want to be really cautious about, you know, staking a flag in the ground saying, oh yeah, this guy's great, look at this, he's had a five game run. Because, you know, we had Cristiano Ronaldo, who no one would argue is bad at scoring goals, have an entire half season where he was really bad at scoring goals. And that just looks like variance, because like there's a lot of football that gets played, it's, you know, laws of large numbers. So be careful about sample size is one big one. Defensive stats, like the stuff that gets quoted, if it's not possession adjusted, it's basically worthless. And then, you know, even when it is possession adjusted, you want to be careful, because like pressing systems will be very different than sort of like a deep block or a middle block. And the system that you play in, the tactical system that you play in, has a big impact on your statistical output. And that's also like a curiosity that you can't always solve. Sometimes there's a bit of magic. There's a bit of like, oh, I've watched a lot of games, so I understand this better and why it's happening. A lot of the stats usage is like signposting. Hey, these guys look like they're really good. Let's dig into them more. Let's do further analysis. And that's like probably the best way to go about it. And then, you know, it's not a simple answer, right? There is some complexity behind it. And you know, we're starting to get to the point where we're starting to use stats and data more for tactics too. You know, what style is this team playing? What do they like to do? What are their habits? Can we break those up?
Oh, nice.
And that's something that you know, I kind of teased out in a piece this past week on, we call it IQ Tactics. We've been working on it for about 3 months and we think it's going to change how coaches interact with data. But, you know, you'll see lots of better visualizations or like passing map visualizations that are more about habits and what do they like to do with the ball? Because usually buildup is rote, right? It's like pattern based. So if you can suss out the pattern and figure out what plan A is, and then shut down plan A, now they have to have like a little bit of friction to do plan B or plan C. So like we think that data helps you do that. And that's one thing that the coaches are open to, as long as you pair it with video.
Okay. So video is always essential.
At the professional level, at the pub level, you know, just listen to somebody smart.
No, I'm
right?
going
to
take it. I'm taking a video down the pub. I'm taking it.
You have a phone.
Do you remember those little cardboard monitors you'd get that you could put your phone in and it kind of turned into a monitor?
Oh, sure.
That never really worked. Yeah. That's immediately what I thought of just then.
The Nintendo Labo type stuff, you know, you get the cardboard boxes, you put your phone in. Like, this is your monitor to watch scouting video down at the pub.
And I will be giving, yeah. I'll be taking the conference from Stamford Bridge to the King's Arms in London. I guess, like, Pato is seen very much as our in-house statistician. What actually made you fall, you know, I mean, in love's probably a bit strong. I mean, barring the wife and the cat, not sure if you love anything. Sure. What got you into stats?
I like to think that I'd just respond to a compelling argument in any way. Like, I mean, like I studied philosophy at school and then at university. And so as a result, like, you're always meant to kind of interrogate your presuppositions. And I remember during the 13-14 Premier League season, Arsenal were up at the top of the table, like, into January, I think. and I saw an article online that said something like, look at their schedule, you know, look at their schedule and look at their underlying performance. Like, this is not going to last. And I looked at it and I said, that's bullshit. Like, we're definitely going to win the league.
Yeah.
And then I started thinking, we're probably not going to win the league. And also we started getting worse because all our fast players got injured and suddenly Mesut Ozil had no one to pass to. And I just thought, why in this one area of my life do I not interrogate like my kind of feelings about things? I just assume that they're based on something. Like, I would not do that in any other regard. So I started reading more about it and I ended up, you know, finding Michael Caley and StatsBomb. And, you know, it helped probably that you were an Arsenal fan because some of those early articles on StatsBomb, you know, were like scouting forwards for Arsenal. And so I remember reading an article that I think was probably that January that recommended, I think it was Lacazette, Griezmann and Aubameyang when he was at Saint-Etienne.
Aubameyang was the summer before. So he went, that was like, Aubameyang was part of my first ever like forward article. It was Lacazette, Griezmann, Aboubakar, I think was one, and someone else that I'm forgetting now.
There were so many guys around then. It was like Lajic and like Jovetic and like so many like kind of names being bandied around, like particularly for Arsenal.
Lamella was that summer before. Yeah. It's fun to look back at those early pieces with like just really basic information, but then saying, hey, these guys who you've never heard of probably, and generally most people hadn't, like Diego Costa, Koke, Ben Yedder as a discount buy for like 10 million euros or something, when like absolutely no one had heard of him. He spends like two more years at Toulouse. And they largely worked out, right? Eriksen was one that like I just got beaten up about.
And I feel like he wasn't even first choice when Spurs were shopping around that summer with the Bale money.
He was like their last signing of the summer. Like in Dortmund, I think, had turned down the chance. Arsenal might have turned down the chance.
Not physical enough. Like, not a great athlete.
He's big. He's so much bigger than you think as well. Like, that's weird.
The Dele Alli one's always the one that surprises me. Like, you go stand next to Dele and you're like, whoa. Yeah. He looks like he's long, but he's an actual unit. And
he's lean.
That doesn't shock me. Yeah. Really.
I mean, I was just going to end it with, were your kind of sentiments getting into it, or, you know, your reasons similar? That it just, was it kind of an extension of the whole gambling thing?
So I was diagnosed with testicular cancer at the end of 2012, and it came as like quite a shock. I couldn't work for a couple of months, and I needed to find something to do with my time because I loved work. Like, I loved trading and analyzing. I was like lead trader for the Premier League, worked on, you know, live American football as well, and all sorts of stuff back at Pinnacle. And so I needed to find something while I was recovering. And I think I wrote my first piece like as the day either before or after I had my dose of chemo. Everything's fine now, don't worry about that. It's actually totally normal for men to be diagnosed with testicular cancer in their mid to late 30s. And so if you're worried about it, you know, definitely go get checked out. So I needed to do something, and suddenly there was this sort of granular player data that was available. I obviously have worked in gambling, and I'm like, all right, so maybe like we'll start poking around with this stuff in the same way that I poked around with the baseball data from before, or looking at the revolution that happened in the NBA and seeing like how they're using stats. And the stuff that I heard early on was, oh, well, football is a much more complex game. Like, it's dynamic. You can't apply stats to this, that, the other thing. I'm like, look, I think this is nonsense, but I'm going to give it a try because like I need something else to think about. And so I started writing a little bit, and then I started looking at it from like a gambling model perspective, which, you know, I kind of, I guess, stupidly had not interrogated it in that way. Like, we were looking at the cost of things around the world, but not necessarily could we build predictive stuff. So all of that came together, and then I started being like, well, maybe we could do predictive elements on like young players and build young player models and find out who the good players around Europe are based on stats, and then we'll look backwards and do some backtesting, and can we project them out? And all of it ended up being, you know, really intriguing. And I stopped playing Football Manager because I was doing it kind of in real life. It was like a total substitute good. and I still don't play Football Manager. I occasionally talk to the guys that run Football Manager about
stuff.
You're
playing it in real life. You've won.
It's really quite odd in that way. I found it interesting. And I've loved soccer or football since I watched it, World Cup 1998.
So, why Arsenal?
The 98 World Cup team, I believe they might have had some decent players that also played for Arsenal at the time. Sure. Could have been Alan Shearer if Newcastle were really good at that time too, right? You're looking for like the best player in England, and that didn't work out. So yeah, and that just like kind of blossomed into this thing where go work for the clubs and find. I love problem solving. So the StatsBomb doesn't just do like stats. Like we ended up doing tactical stuff as well. And can we find a better way to play the game? And the set pieces stuff was actually the first project that I ever worked on. Matthew Benham brought me in the summer of 2014. And he's like, so it's great that you're doing all this player stuff and data, but I want you to look at set pieces. I'm like, I'm not a coach. He's like, yeah, but I think there's something here. So I spent my first 6 weeks breaking down a lot of video from the best set piece teams in the world and doing best practice analysis. And can we find a better way to do this? And can we score like more goals in this phase of the game? Because it seems like you should be able to. Like it's a stop, start, you control the situation. And like Pato said, I have no presuppositions. Like I don't have any assumptions that I need to break because like I didn't grow up in this game. And so I didn't have coaches teaching me the wrong way to do things or the old school way. And so then I'm like, all right, so can we figure this out? And Michelin ended up being like really successful at that phase and, you know, helped them win a league title. And we had good coaches behind it too. But I find that that type of tactical problem solving in the same way that you would do in Football Manager is really fun in the real world too. So it carries straight on through if you get a chance to actually work on it and poke around in that side of the game.
Well, it's been really fun having you on. I hope you've enjoyed this as much as you do, you know, poking around with Michelin's set pieces. Pato, anything left, mate?
No, thanks very much.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm sad that we're not just hanging out in the pub like the first time.
I actually tweeted about that saying, do you remember? We didn't want to pay for a taxi, so we carried the equipment ourselves and it was pissing it down.
It's also like 300 meters away.
Yeah. But I remember just interviewing you like moist.
Wow.
Wait,
what a note to end on.
Exactly. And ending. On that note.
So if you enjoyed this, guys, then go and check out our other episodes of Extra Time. What are we on now? Late 20s?
No idea.
No idea.
I sat out 2 months.
That is also true. We have a bit more of a strategy coming for this coming season. It might not be weekly like you guys sort of insist on, but we will strive to make them more interesting when they do drop, and hopefully this is the start of that. And if you enjoyed this, then also go and check out our other podcast. Yeah, right, it very much is actually, you feature on it. The game has gone mad, and that's all I have to say. Goodbye, farewell.